Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Glad to have you all with us today. We've got a terrific panel to talk about the issues in the political news coming up in just a couple minutes. But I'd like to start, if I can, by making a couple quick announcements. First, we continue to put this show up, the video version of it, on Facebook Live. And so if you want to kind of peek in and see what this show, what this radio show looks like, sitting here, when we're sitting here talking in the studio, go to the GPB News Facebook page and you can watch us. I've said it before, I'll say it again. We're now 2 weeks into doing this and the response has been just phenomenal. We're really excited to have you peeking in on us. Jim Galloway, it's been fun, hasn't it?
Oh, it's been terrific. And this afternoon, you can even watch us eat pretzels with sprinkles.
producer Olivia Rheingold brought us some of her homemade pretzels with sprinkles. So, yes, we appreciate that. That was Jim Galloway. Of course, he's the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He also oversees the Political Insider blog at Politically Georgia, which is part of the MyAJC website. And later on, we're going to talk a little bit about a column that you have coming up on Sunday. But if you don't mind, we'll hold that for a little later. Sure. In the show. We also have Loretta Lepore with us. It's a Friday, and Loretta joins us on Friday. She, of course, was the communications director for Republican Governor Sonny Perdue and has been a Republican strategist, actually was a candidate at one point. You thought for a while you were going to get into the legislature.
That was at one time.
Fortunately, she failed.
Once and out. And to tell you something about how smart she is, she never tried it again. Thanks for being here, Loretta.
Happy Friday, everybody.
Howard Franklin is here in the studio with us. He's a Democratic political consultant. He just told us he's come from a long week of lobbying at the state capitol. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And in our Macon office, Lori Johnson is back with us. She's a political science professor at Mercer University. And Lori, we always love having you up on the show because we hear a little bit about what's going on down in Middle Georgia. How are you this afternoon?
I'm doing good. Nice to be along with all of you.
I wish we had a camera that we could include you on our Facebook Live, but we do have a nice note up that tells us when you're talking. It identifies you.
Sounds good.
One other quick note that I wanted to make, and I guess this is sort of an apology, but I think it's a correct one to make. We've heard from some of you that I've been doing a lousy job promoting our Twitter feed and including your comments on Twitter on the show. And you know what? You are right. I have just sort of let it go. And that's a bad idea because we get interesting comments from you on Twitter. So this is my pledge today. If you want to start tweeting us, our handle is @politicsGPB. We will pay. I'm going to pay attention more closely. And we would love to have you back with us on Twitter. And I appreciate those of you who have sent me notes or told me in person that you don't understand why we're not talking about Twitter anymore. So that said, @politicsGPB, let's start tweeting again, folks. All right. Jim Galloway, you had an item in the Political Insider blog today with a headline that was a question. What's on Karen Handel's mind? Republican Congresswoman from the 6th District, Karen Handel. And the answer to that question is?
Pennsylvania.
Help us understand.
All right. Okay. Everybody's familiar now. Connor Lamb won in the 18th Congressional District in Southwest Pennsylvania. Beat a Trumpian Republican. And just by what, seven? Did he even
700 votes?
Yeah, maybe a little bit less.
And they haven't even counted all of the provision, the overseas, the military voting, and all of that. It could be even a closer margin.
Right, right. In 2016, Trump won that district with 20 points to spare, and it's a message to Republican members of Congress across the country: don't get complacent, because this could get dicey. And what was interesting was Karen Handel sent out a fundraising letter. This hit about 4 o'clock, and it just had that one word in the subject line, Pennsylvania, And she was ringing some alarm bells, and and that's okay to do. You know, she says, you know, she wants to help Donald Trump preserve his governing majority in Congress, and that's good. There was a line in there that said, because the path, the Democratic path to taking control of the U.S. House runs through her 6th district. And that's what I took issue with. Because because if you go down the list of vulnerable Republican districts, Georgia's 6th district, Georgia's 7th district with Rob Woodall, neither of them are on it. In fact, the Cook Political Report this morning reconfigured. They handicap races. They pushed nine more congressional districts from the Republican column into the likely Democratic column. None of them are in Georgia. So the bottom line, my message was, if you see Karen Handel or Rob Woodall losing next November, the Republicans have already lost the House. That race is over.
Lori, let me turn to you, if I may, on this, because the 18th district race in Pennsylvania has been one of the biggest political stories this week. You know, it seems to me that what that race showed a couple things, of course. But one of the things it showed, I think, is that Trump's popularity is not transferable. Trump is Trump, and candidates like Rick Saccone in Pennsylvania or like Roy Moore in Alabama or any number of others, they don't get much bounce from having Trump endorse them, do they?
That seems to be proving to be the case. I think the race also tells us something about the tension that voters in any congressional race face, and that's that they're electing their representative on local issues and issues they care about. But once they get into Washington, the way our government is structured, your political party affiliation matters a lot. And so, yeah, even if you're running on the same issues that he ran on, if you're a Democrat, once you're in Washington, you're going to be part of the Democratic caucus. I think in the letter that Jim was referring to, Karen Handel also emphasized Nancy Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi.
Three times.
as the strategy to combat that. And, you know, one of the things that people have to grapple with at the local level is, you know, you say you're a Democrat. Does that mean you're a Democrat like all the other Democrats, like one from San Francisco, you know? And so Democrats have to deal with that issue, but they seem to be doing better at it.
Loretta?
Yes. I think there's a couple things about it. I think it's fairly typical for a candidate to play on current issues in order to raise funding. I think the Nancy Pelosi play is probably not going to be as effective this go-around as it was last go-around.
Why?
I think that really worked. Well, I just think that Nancy Pelosi was a good lightning rod, and that race, when Karen Handel ran the first time, it was a special election. So it wasn't in a crowded field of races, right? So it resonated more. There were more people listening to it. I just don't think that that's as topical right now. I think there are so many other things going on. Plus, I think whoever the Democratic candidate is comes out of the primary, they're going to force her to talk about other issues. And so it's going to be, I think, more of an issue-driven campaign this time around than a person campaign.
Yeah, I agree with Loretta. I think more than a name recognition campaign, which is all it essentially was. You get, 17, 19, 18 candidates last time out. So it really was who could get their name out there in a very short timeline, most quickly and on television, et cetera. But I think part of what was impressive about what Conor Lamb was able to do was he didn't have to go after Trump directly. He focused and campaigned on local issues. And the question is, will CD6 be focused on local issues or will we go straight to Trump? Are we nationalizing our congressional races? Or are we still trying to focus on the issues that have plagued or have been difficult and thorny for Georgia politicians to deal with?
Yeah, quite frankly, I think we've got a situation in this, both the 6th and the 7th, because they're on the kind of the northern arc of Metro Atlanta, where for the last several cycles, Republicans have been very, very quick to nationalize their contests. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to see the opposite this November. I think you're going to see Karen Handel and Rob Woodall go very, very local. not to overtly separate themselves from Donald Trump, but to establish a separate brand.
Well, that's one of the lessons we learned from watching the Pennsylvania 18th. I mean, Conor Lamb certainly didn't run as a National Democrat. And so, you know, he was concerned about the steel industry and so was not outspoken against the tariffs that Trump is imposing. I mean,
he was a Democratic operative's ideal candidate in so many
in
ways.
In certain districts.
In that district, I'm saying.
Yes, exactly.
And that he knew the issues that were going to resonate or their campaign knew the issues of import to that local community, that local district. And he was able to articulate beautifully. And they had to thread the needle on a couple of things. You know, he is Catholic, so he is personally right to life, but will uphold the Constitution. He, you know, threaded the needle on the tariff situation because of what his demographics in that district look like. He was articulate. He was young. He was energetic, running against a candidate who had so little enthusiasm and so little, shall we say, energy. A very low energy.
And
he did not raise money.
So let me, Laurie and Howard, before we get out of this, I'm interested in this. I think it's really wonderful to say that Conor Lamb was the perfect choice in that district because it's always going to be a district. Well, it's about to change, and in the fall we'll see where Conor Lamb, you know, has to run with the new districts that have been drawn by a federal court, but. In a state like California, Howard, the chances of a Democrat being able to run, you're going to end up having to please the progressives in
That's
the
right.
party as well as the more moderate Democrats. So with that in mind, what does that tell? Isn't Georgia, aren't the Democrats who are running in Georgia fortunate because they're not, are there that many, like the 6th or Woodall 7th? You don't have these splits in the Democratic Party,
yeah.
do you? Of really progressive as opposed to moderate Democrats?
I think the bigger issue there, so you're right, but I think the bigger issue there is that Conor was able to clear out the primary. So if he had had a competitive primary contest, I'm sure, you know, to the left and to the, or at least to the left of him, he would have had to lay down some Democratic issues that would have might have made the general election, the special, a little more difficult. I think the issue here, and you know, if anyone from Pennsylvania wants to call us and give us any tips, we need to figure out how not to get clown car primaries when you've got what you believe to be a potentially endangered Republican incumbent. And I mean, maybe John Ossoff is a congressman today if there aren't 5 Democrats running for that seat. I don't know how 6 and 7 will shake out
right,
this time.
Right. I was going to say you don't have the split. You might have the split in the 6th over gender. Over
right.
gender and race, because Lucy McBath is a gun violence activist. She's African American. She's female. She jumped into the race late when you had two white Democrats, Kevin Abel and Bobby Cable. Get in there, and both of them had raised significant amounts of money on the notion that their only worry was whether John Ossoff was going to get into the race. There's also the 10th district. Against Jody Heiss, you do have, and that's where you have kind of some Athens-based tension between the Bernie Sanders faction and your traditional Democratic faction.
True. Okay, Laurie. As long as we're talking congressional races, Drew Ferguson, your congressman down there in Middle Georgia, has drawn an opponent from the right. Can you fill us in? Why is Ferguson getting challenged down there, and what are the chances that he could, in fact, have a significant opponent in this race?
I don't know. I haven't followed any polling or anything about, you know, whether the challenge is realistic. But I think that lots of politicians are going to get challenges this year because people are activated and motivated, and they're seeing this as something that's worth challenging, worth doing, even if they're not likely to win, to change the conversation, to change the debate. So that motivation is going to bring more people out of the out to run, and we know it's bringing more women out to run, and so the conversations should change because of that.
Yeah, this is a district that goes down to Drew Ferguson's district goes down to I think to the edge of Columbus and a good bit east. Bill, this is the right word challenge is kind of a leftover from the previous cycles of combat between Drew Ferguson and Mike Crane,
who is
very, very much on the right side.
Before we move on, a couple quick comments. We have somebody's watching us on Facebook Live, Ray Northwood, who says, those of us in the 6th District were surprised that Ms. Handel, who can't seem to manage a town hall here in the district, these are his words, can travel to address Republicans in Pennsylvania. Loretta, she went to the Trump rally in Allegheny County the Saturday before the special election, and he gave her a shout out and brought her up to the applause of the crowd.
Well, he took credit for her victory, too.
Yes, he did, in fact. Loretta, it was an interesting moment in that rally, I thought.
It was an interesting. all I can say is it was interesting. I actually heard that on the news as it was happening, and it was a little out of sorts from my head to register, like, where am I and what am I listening to? It just seemed a little off for me. Obviously, I don't know how Karen responds with her constituents in her district, but I know that there are a lot of members right now that are, and I mean that members of Congress, that are traveling to other districts to help shore up support for candidates that are in special elections and so forth. So it's not atypical for a member of Congress to go to another district. It's just that she's somewhat vulnerable at this point in time, and so it seemed an odd placement for her.
All right, I'll tell you what.
Going to also say what we saw in Pennsylvania was a president with almost zero experience doing this himself, campaigning for someone besides himself. He made the whole rally about him.
He did.
And he barely even managed to introduce the candidate. He has no experience within a formal political party paying loyalty dues to that party and supporting other people. And, that has repercussions for governance, not just for elections and campaigns.
All right. Howard, you want to get one last word in before we take a break?
Earlier you mentioned that Trump is Trump and that his coattails haven't worked for other members of Congress, and this is part of the reason why, in my opinion.
All right. We are going to take our first break of the show, and as we do, we want to thank our viewers on Facebook Live. We have people in Clarksville, Walton County, Warner Robins, Swainsboro. You're watching us on Facebook Live, and I hope listening on the radio from all over the state. And remember, tweet us at PoliticsGPB. We'll be right back.
Now is the perfect time to clean out the garage and get rid of that car you no longer need. You'll face the coming months with a fresh start, and by donating your used car to GPB, you'll even get a tax deduction. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
I'm gonna get in my car. Drive so far.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Howard Franklin, Loretta Lepore, Lori Johnson down in Macon, and Jim Galloway all here for the show today. There were a couple of headlines from the legislature that really caught my eye. I'd love to know whether all of you here on the show today agree with me that these were really worth looking at. Jim, we know that there has been a push to pass a distracted driving bill in the legislature, a statute that would call for people to use hands-free cell phones while they're in the car. There was a hearing on it yesterday, and I think one of the reasons that I found it particularly meaningful was, number one, you had Representative Ed Setzer making a statement that says, I love talking on my phone. I do all my work on the phone. I drive way up 75. And really affirming the need for that. And on the other hand, you had Mary Carol Harsh, whose husband was killed presumably in an accident, presumably with a distracted driver. The tensions there are palpable and probably represent a lot of the feelings across the state.
And they're very real. Look, Ed Setzler is a Republican from Acworth. He lives not too far from me, and he and I have the same commute. And we are both on the phone all the time. I do use my earbud, which makes it, I think, technically hands free. But look, as bad as traffic is, it's hard not to use your phone when you're devoting 3 hours of your day to getting to and from work. But then you get into the safety issue. And John Carson, who's the sponsor, who's also from Cobb County, mm-hmm. makes an excellent point in that, you know, you're seeing accidents go up, you're seeing insurance rates go up. And the strange thing about it is the accident increases are in single car incidents. Which speaks to the distracted driver.
3,477 people, according to the National Highway Safety Administration, died in U.S. crashes because of distracted drivers. And Jim, between 2014 and 2016, traffic accidents rose here in Georgia by some 36%, and our insurance premium spiked as a result of that sort of thing. Loretta, first of all, we should make it clear, this bill does not ban using your cell phone.
Right, it's
it just
hands-free.
Insists, like a Galloway, you have to have some device that you don't have to hold it and punch into it necessarily.
And a lot of cars are being made that way now, where you can have Bluetooth, hands-free kind of driving range. But this really is a bigger issue for some of these members, where it's about ideology versus real-world practicality. And that comes down to, you know, personal individual freedom versus public safety. And, you know, to Representative Setzler's point, it's the point of, look, you know, we're all grown-ups. We should know how to drive. We should know which decisions to make about using our phone or not using our phone. This is for a decision for each of us as individuals to make.
Go ahead.
Yes. And then on the other side, you have Representative Carson, who's saying, look, the cost is too high. And we're seeing it in terms of deaths. And that's just too high a cost. Forget, you know, don't even look to the insurance premiums, but the cost of life is too high. We had this exact same debate back in 2004 about seatbelts. And part of that, too, was about raising the age limit of which children had to be in seatbelts and car seats. And the resistance was fierce. And not to say that Governor Perdue was not particularly in favor of the legislation. But at the end of the day, that legislation moved forward and passed because there was federal money attached to it.
Yeah.
So there was a ton of public safety money coming from the federal government to, you know, into our state to help, you know, patrol the roads.
So a couple questions about that, Howard. Number one, I do understand the personal liberty issue and that there are people who see it as another encroachment upon that. At the same time, there are speed limits. You know, I might feel like I'm perfectly safe driving 95 miles an hour on Interstate 85, but the government says, no, you're in danger when you do that. So it isn't as if we don't accept. It's really about a further erosion, I think.
I think it's a bunch of things. I mean, to Loretta's point, I don't think you're making this point, but the representative, we're not all adults in these vehicles. And whether or not a seatbelt used in my vehicle will not impact what happens in an accident to someone else's vehicle. And I think we go through this every year at the General Assembly. As technology advances, as these little cell phones demand more of our attention, produce more and more apps, you know, have more and more notifications, in any other arena, we are figuring out ways to change our behavior, legislatively and otherwise, in terms of regulation, so that we are responsive to how technology is changing. And in this case, I think we just need to get there. I don't know what that has to look like. I think plenty of other states have also, you know, required hands-free driving devices, et cetera. But when you put all those issues on top of the fact that Atlanta, Metro Atlanta, has some of the worst traffic of any metropolitan area in the country, those are just two things that they're combustible. And I think legislation has to be passed.
Well, but it is going to have a hard time this year because the basic situation here is, yes, the House has passed John Carson's bill, I think with a pretty darn good margin.
Big margin.
Big margin.
But the Senate, it's gotten caught up in the race for governor because Casey Cagle has said it will have an uphill climb to get to a vote on the chamber floor. You've already got Michael Williams saying he would be against it. You've got more than likely it'll hit. I think it's scheduled for a judiciary hearing next week. But whether it can get to the floor, I'm not sure. This is probably going to be a multi-year effort.
I totally agree. And I think we went into the 2018 session expecting it's an election year. It's a gubernatorial election year, you know, first time for a new governor in 8 years, Tourist Town for a new lieutenant governor in 12. We did not expect to get a whole lot of stuff done, especially if there's going to be any sort of political controversy surrounding
it. They talked about seatbelts for a long time, mandatory seatbelts, before they finally passed them. One of the obstacles there that I thought most interesting was Tom Murphy, when he was Speaker of the House. I've mentioned before on the air that he opposed, he always blocked this, but he did it for a somewhat unique reason.
The exemption was for pickup trucks.
Okay, that's right, which I understand that. But Murphy believed that Tom Murphy's daughter, grown daughter, was involved in an automobile accident. She was not wearing her seatbelt. She was thrown clear of the crash, and Murphy was convinced that had she been in a seatbelt, she would have been pinned in the car and killed. So, Lori, these fights sometimes take on strange twists and turns, but maybe this is a multi-year effort, Lori.
Right. I think that's true. And I also think that I don't think anybody's really imagining that you're going to get arrested or ticketed for being on your phone while you're driving. That's just almost impossible to enforce. But if you do cause an accident, then that's where the evidence of whether you were on your phone or not is going to be easily available in a lawsuit. And the question of whether you were distracted as part of the cause for the accident is real. I mean, you know, we drive these death-making machines around and we reach for a French fry without thinking about, I could kill somebody when I do that. And so anything that changes that mental calculation, I think, could be beneficial. But I don't think anybody's imagining this law is going to be enforced in any great degree.
Lorette, before we leave this topic, I want to pick up on Jim's point that this has become an issue in the governor's race. Mm-hmm. So are Republicans going to do you imagine that this is an issue that Republicans will look at and say, well, Casey Cagle is the toughest one on blocking distracted driving legislation. I'll vote for him. How is this going to play into the bigger notions of the race?
I don't think it's going to have a big play. I mean, I think this is an issue pending in the legislature. I think it's the bigger ideological issue that it will play in the governor's race. And that's why, you know, when all the gubernatorial candidates were asked this question at the Columbus debate, right? And so that's why it was brought to the fore, and that's how we got all of their positions on the issue. But it's more broadly, and the reason that a lot of them spoke the way they spoke and responded to that question was clearly outlining their ideological position and who was the most conservative in terms of less government being involved in your life.
Yeah, okay. I agree. But I think also the fact that you have so many candidates, in many cases well-funded candidates, running in this gubernatorial primary leaves these little issues to potentially give someone a leg up. And so if you had a 2 or 3-person race, you know, you'd be guaranteed that this would be fighting amongst themselves for a double-digit win, right? In this case, it might come down to just a few points.
But okay, I think this issue is also going to be a personal issue, too, because as you pointed out, there are members of the legislature who have lost loved ones, as was pointed out in the same article, you know, that have certain feelings, and they're Republicans. You also have John Carson, who's a Republican, who's the proponent of the bill. So it's not an issue where you're going to have unity among Republicans.
And it could become an issue in the general election, except that you'll notice that when Casey said this legislation will have an uphill battle, he wasn't exactly opposing it.
Yes, that's right. It was. I thought that was really interesting. Thank you for pointing that out, Jim. Another headline that caught my eye was a vote on a resolution in the House. This year, Alan Peake, who is about to finish up his final session in the legislature, he's from down your way, of course, in Macon, Lori, and he has been the leading advocate for medical marijuana. He has worked, he has repeatedly been praised by the Speaker of the House, David Ralston, for his efforts in advancing the use of medical marijuana for illnesses, conditions that especially children are suffering with. But this year, the House and Senate both chose not to add other conditions to the list. They also refused to take up a measure that would allow for some small manufacturing of medical marijuana here in Georgia. And because of that, they passed a resolution, Lori, that was interesting. They voted 158-5 to to say to Congress, it's time that you take action to study medical marijuana, either by reclassifying it as a Schedule II drug, it's now Schedule I, it's right up there with heroin, or by passing a separate law. So it's interesting that a bipartisan, a majority, vast majority in the House, what they seem to say, we just want clarification from the feds, Lori.
Well, they want information. They want research. I mean, this is a part of legislating that doesn't tend to get covered a lot in the media, but people do want to know what the data shows. What's the evidence? What, you know, what can we base our decision on? And when the and that's one of the ways the federal government can help out state legislators. I mean, this is an issue that's sort of quintessential federalism. We've seen states experimenting with lots of different ways of approaching both medicinal and recreational marijuana. But at some point, we should be getting some clearer pattern about what's what the repercussions of this are and how we should proceed. And that needs to come from the federal level.
I just think it was a great scene to have the chairman of the House Health and Human Services Committee, Sharon Cooper, get up and say, Congress needs to get off its duff and do something. There is a whole lot of frustration because Alan Peake's work has become very popular among voters and in the legislature. But to move further, Governor Deal, Casey Cagle, others have said that our hands are in a set of handcuffs because we can't do that research because where Peake has fallen down is in this latest round is he's been pushing to try to find a spot in Georgia where medicinal marijuana can be cultivated.
Yes.
You know, a university experimental station is a fine place
except
for that.
Except that the stumbling block is
the Schedule I.
It's Schedule I drug. Go ahead, Lori.
And Attorney General Jeff Sessions is not a person you would look to help with this issue. But, you know, the CDC is right here in Georgia. But they're not allowed to do research either, as far as I know, on Schedule I drugs. So, you know, this is a question of how much the states really can do without some shift in the federal perspective.
Everything that's happening right now is somewhat anecdotal, right? So we know that there are patients who have seizures, who have cancer, benefit greatly. But when legislators are forming and passing legislation, they turn to the experts. And when they turn to the medical community says, we don't know. We can take a best guess. We could tell you what we see in our patients. We can tell you what we hear. We could tell you where the research to date is, but we can't tell you yes or no. And that's a problem from a legislative perspective. And so I think Representative Cooper made a very valid point that the federal government needs to really get off the stick and do some research in this area.
Well, also lost in all this conversation, the state legislature has also authorized a study committee this summer and through the rest of the year on exactly the same topic. I expect that committee will come back with a report and they'll make a stronger pitch to Congress if they don't see action in the next year or so.
All right.
That was an interesting move by Mr. Cagle to put off what could be a volatile another volatile issue
That's
in the
right.
primary until the next year.
That's right.
Well, Alan Peake is a great Alan Peake is a great case study in how one political elected official can put an issue on an agenda and force that issue to be confronted. And we tend to think nobody can do that. You have to get a majority. And he's done it. He put that issue on the agenda.
That's a great point. Let's get to one more issue before we take another break. DeKalb County Commission here in Metro Atlanta voted to give themselves a big, big pay raise, 60%. I'm not sure if it's deserved or not. That's not the point, really. There's at least one person in the studio looking at me like, what, are you crazy to think that it might be deserved? I won't say who that is. And as a response to that, you have a senator from DeKalb County saying, not so fast, Jim.
Yeah, Fran Miller has put a, I think it's a House legislation. I can't call the number right now, but it's in the Senate. Fran Miller has
SB 430.
Oh, so it's in the House. I'm sorry, it's in the House now. But Fran Miller is asking for an amendment to it that would this is a bill that would let county commissioners give themselves pay raises across the state, all 159 counties. But Miller's amendment would delay that so that, yes, you can approve the pay raise, but it doesn't go into effect until your term has expired and you are reelected.
You know, it's funny. Loretta, I sort of thought when our Tom Faust presented this item as part of the conversation, I thought, well, it's not that big a deal. But this is our money. This is taxpayers' money. And maybe the notion that people should not be able to give themselves a raise is one that we really ought to be paying close attention to.
Well, it's how we got this 27th Amendment. I mean, that sat around for over 200 years until people finally said, yeah, this was a good idea that Madison had, that members of Congress can't give themselves a raise that takes effect until after the next election. That's the 27th Amendment.
Right, and the people should be able to have some say in this, and they're having their way to have some say in it is at the ballot box, and I think that's what Senator Miller's legislation does.
But the twist here is that one of the commissioners on the TCAD commission, who Nancy Jester, only Republican, mm-hmm. she opposes the raises, mm-hmm. but now she's also opposing Fran Miller's amendment because DeKalb County the terms are staggered on the DeKalb County Commission, and it just so happens that the men on the commission finish up their terms before the women. So if this goes into effect for a whole year, the men will be paid 62% more than the women.
All right. Well, we'll follow that and see where it goes. We got to take a break. As we go to break, thank you. We said if you come back to Politics GPB, our Twitter handle, we'll pay more attention. And we have Robert Jimison tweets us, have we not accepted that traditional bellwether analysis went out the door? Speaking of the notion of, you know, analyzing data about things like medical marijuana, I suppose, with everything else in this political season, he makes a point. Science doesn't seem to have much of an impact these days, which doesn't mean we shouldn't be studying these things. Richard Bodor says, unless the Georgia Supremes force the end to gerrymandered districts, there is no change to expect from the, quote, purpling of Metro Atlanta to the ruby redness of the rest of the state. Great talk, though. I love to listen to Politics GPB. Thank you very much, Richard. And we do have this highly gerrymandered state, going back to the congressional conversation. But your one comment from you before we go to break, Jim. But the 7th District up there with Rob Woodall is turning purple. Whether or not it goes Democratic is another question.
Right. And look, the sixth district is changing.
Yeah.
You have for the first time, you have pretty much every contested every race in Cobb County contested by a Democrat, which hasn't happened since the late 70s.
Yeah. It's interesting to watch all that develop. All right. We're going to get another break out of the way as we do. Lori Johnson, I want to make sure you know, we've told our listeners once, we're heading to Macon on April 12th, Thursday night, April 12th. We're going to do Political Rewind in front of a live audience down there. And we don't have details yet. I'm hoping that we'll start talking about that on the shows next week. But if you're in the Macon area, if you like Political Rewind, keep track of our show because we'll pretty soon have details on where we're going to be, how you can get free tickets to attend the event. We'd love to have you join us on Thursday night, April 12th. All right, let's take a break and we'll come right back for the rest of the show.
Elon Musk says he might fire up his Mars rocket as early as next year for testing. I'm Flora Lichtman. Join me on Science Friday as we imagine life in a Mars colony. Where would we live? What would we do? And most importantly, what's for dinner? I hope you like mushrooms. Plus, a magnetosphere mystery named Steve. That's on Science Friday from PRI.
3 o'clock today here on GPB.
You're now watching us in Rome, Columbus, Tucker, Albany, and up in Rabun County. And Sean Williamson is watching Jim Galloway. He says, longtime listener, first time watcher, but he has a question for you. Why is Jim wearing a name tag? Doesn't everyone know who he is?
Oh. No, I just have to remember who I am every now and then.
All right, let's. I want to talk for a few minutes about the fact that Vice President Pence is heading to the state, and you know, like everything, Jim, his visit here is creating quite a storm down there. He's going to be at the St. Patrick's Day festivities in Savannah, which, by the way, given his evangelical beliefs, is the last place you'd expect to see Mike Pence on St. Patrick's Day.
No. The organizers of the St. Patrick's Day parade are quite religious, and they pay attention to the religious side, the you know, chasing the snakes out of Ireland kind of thing. But the rest of Savannah, it's
not
kinda,
so much.
It's kind of like a Mardi Gras.
That's right.
And if you've been to Savannah, you know they've got a pretty good troupe of drag queens that like to appear at appearances like this. It's a very strong LGBT community, and the presence of Pence has created some tension. There's the city of Savannah has created a 12 block kind of limited fun zone. where they're banning tents, portable chairs, backpacks. They had prohibited signs, but the local ACLU filed suit this morning. They backed off very quickly. You will be able to carry protest signs. They can't be on sticks, but you can have little bits of poster in there.
Howard, I think you know we spent a good amount of the time of our time on the show on Wednesday talking about the erosion of First Amendment rights that we've seen recently. I won't recount the specifics that we discussed, but this notion that you couldn't carry a handmade sign, presumably, it's hard to see it as a security issue, presumably to prevent there from being protest signs that would somehow embarrass the vice president. I think whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, you got to be a little troubled by
that. This is absolutely troublesome. This is governance on training wheels, right? Like, even if you thought it was a good idea to try to ban protest or to discourage protesters, it's incredible you try to codify the rule that would prevent First Amendment speech. And so I don't even know what to say about this. When you think about the half dozen or so times that the Trump administration, its leaders have come to Georgia and they've made all these political snafus. We were just talking earlier about Trump, down in Pennsylvania, taking what should have been an actual endorsement and making it about himself and his reelection and Karen Handel, et cetera. I mean, these guys are just having fun. They're not out here to govern, obviously.
There's even one even more disturbing rule that the city hasn't backed off on. And that is, if you live in that 12 block zone, and you're entirely free to drink a can of Bud or a bottle of Bud in your house.
Yeah, don't bring it out on the porch.
You may not step outside with it.
Yeah. But I thought it just had to be in a plastic cup.
Yeah.
You can bring it in a plastic cup. It just can't be glass.
It has to be in a disposable cup.
So, Loretta, what do you think? You're the Republican at the table today. What do you think Mike Pence is going to make of some of the people he's likely to see down there in Savannah?
Well, it was an interesting move by the vice president, candidly, and picking it at this weekend is even more interesting because it's just Rebel City down there, as you likened it to Mardi Gras. And in terms of the protesters, I think one of the things I think that worked for us. Savannah's certainly not averse to protest groups or big events. They're accustomed to that. During the G8 summit, we were expecting a huge number of protesters, as usually turn out at those events. And the attack that the community made and the governor made at that time was, you are welcome to be here and you are welcome to protest. Just please do it civilly and lawfully. And I think that's really the line, right, is you are free to protest. You have a First Amendment right. Just please obey the law and do it peacefully.
Mary Landers tweets to us, Pence visit concerns are not just about the LGBT community. Bars, restaurants in the zone are worried about losing money on their biggest day of the year. Lori Johnson, that is an issue. If you're in that 12-block radius, you're going to have trouble making any money on one of the most important days of the year for you as a merchant.
It sounds plausible to me to be concerned. I mean, I don't know how this coordination happened or the planning of this, but it seems like somebody missed a few steps along the way.
Yeah, well,
I'll be anticipating how this would be received.
Yeah, by the way, Mary Landers is listening to us from Savannah. All right, well, we'll see how that goes. We'll talk about it on Monday.
One thing we should add, I think, and Lori, help me out here. Mike Pence is supposed to be at the state GOP fundraiser. Is it next week?
Next Tuesday, isn't it? Next Tuesday or Wednesday?
Right. Yes, I believe
he's
it is.
He's going to be, that's right. He will
he's
be.
He's the keynote.
He's the keynote speaker at the annual state Republican Party.
The President's Dinner.
President's Dinner. So we'll be able to report on that. I think that's Tuesday night, but somebody who's listening who knows better than I can certainly send us a message and let us know if that is true or not. By the way, one other quick note about Mike Pence. Huffington Post did a major takeout on Nick Ayers, the vice president's chief of staff. We're going to talk about it more next week. And in fact, we're looking right now to see if the journalist who wrote this piece about this wunderkind who we all watched when he was still a young 21, 22-year-old political consultant in the state of Georgia has risen to the highest ranks of Republican Party politics. And I think the headline takeaway, Loretta, of this piece is that before Nick Ayers came to the vice president's staff, because of the way he was conducting himself in regard to the president, his chances of really emerging as a candidate for president down the road were not as strong as they are now that Nick has come in to help guide him. It's an interesting theory, at least.
Well, there was a lot of talk about that when Nick first, you know, arrived at the White House, that they needed somebody who had a little stronger political instincts working with the vice president.
Yeah. Right. Mr. Pence was being excluded from some very important closed-door meetings, and Mr. Ayers kind of opened the door and made sure that he got into
those. Well, we still have yet to see how this whole, you know, Pence-Trump marriage or Trump-Pence marriage has yet to work out. We're a year and a couple months into it. I still wouldn't make any bets that he's going to emerge unscathed from it when it's all said and done.
All right, let's move on to another legislative matter that I think is worth at least a brief discussion. Jim, we've talked about it on the show before, but the bill is moving forward, and so it's worth talking about it again. The bill to shorten Atlanta voting hours is making progress. This is the measure which would call for the city of Atlanta, which has voting hours from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m., to conform with the rest of the state, which is 7 to 7.
This is Josh McCoon's
bill,
McCoon,
right? Josh McCoon, candidate for Secretary of State,
and it's
Republican.
It's in the House, and as I've got to tell you, it's likely to pass.
Yeah.
And the reason it's likely to pass is because it shortens the hours of voting in a very Democratic area. And we've got a big, tough vote that may be coming up for Republicans in Georgia in November.
Yeah, I was in the Atlanta delegation meeting, I guess it was last week, and this was presented, and, you know, a lot of conversation about it from members, House and Senate, who are concerned about it. And one of the lobbyists for the city got up and explained that this exception had been made because traffic in Atlanta was so bad, and we were acknowledging that many people vote after work and basically trying to make some additional time for folks to make it to the polls. So I hate to hear that in any case we're shortening or making it more difficult for folks to cast a ballot, especially with all that's going on today. But I know a lot of folks are fighting against this, and I'm hopeful that it doesn't get through the legislature.
Well, Lori Jansen, excuse me, I just want to understand whether the justification for this is essentially, well, the whole state should conform
uniformity.
To the state. There should be uniformity. But this seems like a pretty transparent effort, Lori, to cut down. It does feel like a voter suppression measure that's going to make it harder for some people in Atlanta to vote, Lori.
It sounds that way to me, too. I mean, uniformity sounds good in theory. In practice, we have an incredibly decentralized election system with each county election board making decisions for their county's elections. There are a lot of problems with that model, But I wouldn't think that the lack of timing of the opening of the polls was the first one on the list.
Yeah, just to come to back to this for a second, I mean, we had the same conversation back in 2014 when the Democratic Party was looking, a number of the local elections division's chiefs were extending voting hours on Saturdays and Sundays, and there was a Republican outroar or outrage about whether or not that was legal, if you know, whether or not consistency should rule the day. And at the end of the day, it was allowed. So I think we're having the same conversation about the start and end of school
years. And I think this bill also curtails weekend voting.
It
limits it to one Saturday or one Sunday,
yes,
but
exactly
not both.
That's exactly right. All right, let me move on. By the way, Sam Burnham tweets, seems like drinking beer on my front porch is protected by the Fourth Amendment, which, of course, is the amendment that prevents unlawful search and seizures. Rebecca Gaunt says resolutions, talking about the resolution on getting Congress to study demanding there be a study of medical marijuana. Resolutions are meaningless, and suddenly Sharon Cooper wants to know if it works after ignoring caregiver testimony and intentional spreading of misinformation. I don't know that Sharon Cooper has spread misinformation, but they certainly have had people down there, Rebecca would point out, at the Capitol testifying in this. All right, we have resisted, and Loretta, I want to start with you. We have only a couple minutes left. I have not talked about Stormy Daniels for a couple weeks.
Oh, I knew as soon as you opened that it was going to be something that was from page six of the New
York. But this is no law. But this has become an increasingly serious issue that the White House is going to have to deal with. And this morning, you have her attorney who's out trumping Trump. I think he's outmaneuvering Trump, saying that, yes, she was threatened physically to not talk. Now, we don't know who threatened her. We don't know the credibility of it. But this is no longer something that we can just sort of say, oh, this is kind of gross. We don't want to go there.
Well, this has much more to do with infidelity now than it does with truth-telling and potential improprieties from a legal perspective. Who was involved with that? Were there members of the Trump organization? There's now some evidence that there was someone within the organization that at least on her private time, so they say, helped Michael Cohen out, or Michael Cohen's attorney, who's Donald Trump's personal attorney, who allegedly paid off Stormy Daniels. So it's become a legal issue. And then I think today's latest news was that there were other women who are coming forward
the
now.
The attorney says there are six.
Yes, that have similar claims that they were paid hush money and are under non-disclosure agreements.
Yeah, I think the most serious issue coming out of this is just whether the $130,000 in alleged hush money it constitutes a campaign contribution.
Yeah, there is going to be an investigation of that.
And that requires an FEC investigation.
Yep. Right.
And right now, it's the FEC is a fairly weak body. Kind of paralyzed.
Well, they point back to the John Edwards case, right?
Exactly,
it was very similar in terms of the money flow and a third party being involved, and the FCC didn't take action there either.
All right, I am completely out of time. I'm going to make the last comment on this one. It would be ironic if, in fact, after all of the investigation of Russian collusion with the Trump campaign, possible obstruction of justice— if, in fact, there is a possibility that what could bring down the Trump White House is an affair with a porn star, it is now a fairly serious matter, and we'll watch how it unfolds. Howard Franklin, Laurie Johnson down in Macon, Loretta Lepore, Jim Galloway, really terrific to have you all on the show today. Thanks for being with us, and we're back on Monday at 2. If you don't listen to us on the radio, you can always subscribe to our podcast and listen to all of our shows there. I'm Bill Nygut. Take care.